And we are going to do that next week as well. Seems to go over very nicely, where we get a chance to socialize. And I could mention to you that this society is entirely self-sustaining, and we certainly would appreciate your membership. And if you want to go beyond that to a donation, it would certainly help with the finances. You realize, of course, that we pay none of the speakers. They're volunteers, and therefore the expenses for advertising, which takes up the largest part of our budget, is greatly helped by your membership. Now, my pleasure this evening to introduce Professor Jamie Matthews of the Department of Physics and Astronomy. He is the mission scientist for the MOST project, a suitcase-sized microsatellite scheduled for launch in the year 2002-2003, which will be Canada's first space observatory, and which team members affectionately call the Hubble Space Telescope. MOST will give us clues to the age of the universe and the future of our sun. It should also unveil some of the mysteries about alien planetary systems recently discovered around other star-like stars. Dr. Matthews sits on the board of the H.R. Macmillan Space Centre, is Canada's education representative to the International Astronomical Union, and won one of the 1999 Killam Prizes for teaching excellence in the UBC Faculty of Science. With those qualifications, I can hardly wait to hear what he has to say. Help me welcome Professor Matthews.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and thank you all for coming out on a beautiful Saturday night to listen to me speak. I have to warn you that this talk is the first time I've given this version of the talk, multimedia, PowerPoint, computer presentation, and slides that I'm going to try to keep coordinated. And although I'm supposed to be a rocket scientist, I can barely chew gum and walk at the same time. So we'll see if I can keep the slides and the computer stuff going at the same time. I'm going to just lower some of the lights with your indulgence, just because astronomers are always showing these beautiful, colorful pictures, and it helps if they are in a slightly dark background. So tonight I'm going to try to give you a status report on something that sounds like science fiction, but is in fact state-of-the-art science, and that's the search for alien worlds. Now, I called it that because if I called it, the Doppler monitoring of solar-type stars for substellar companions, then I would be talking to about four or five people tonight. But alien world is just a very poetic way of describing what astronomers would refer to as an extrasolar planet or an exoplanet. A planet orbiting a star other than the sun. Now, there are searches for planets within our own solar system beyond the ones that we know about, and none have turned up yet. I'm not going to talk about that at all, but if anyone's curious about the search for planet X in our own solar system, I'd be happy to talk about that during the question period afterwards. So let's get underway, and let's see if I know which buttons to press in which order. The first thing that I'm going to do, any scientist, it behooves us to justify our research to the community at large, to our government funding agencies and so on. Why is it worth doing this? Why should we be looking for exoplanets? And there are a number of arguments that are brought to play. In fact, when I give talks to people from elementary school age to adult ages, I often ask people, why do they think it's interesting to search for planets around other stars? One of the answers that I get a lot from people is that, well, maybe we could find a new place to move to once we destroy the planet Earth. And the problem is that the stars are very far away. Compared to the planets in our solar system. Our nearest neighboring planet, or the one that certainly we have a lot of interest in, Mars, is 600,000 times closest than the nearest star, and we don't know whether that star has planets around it. And we're not even close to sending one person, let alone the entire population of the Earth, to Mars, let alone another star system. So really, in the foreseeable future, we're not going to be able to travel to other worlds with any kind of foreseeable technology. Space Shuttle lifted off just a few days ago with Marc Garneau on board, a Canadian astronaut, to refurbish the space station with solar panels. And this kind of technology with space probes, interplanetary probes, we have been able to send probes which have left our own solar system, but they're moving at a snail's pace compared to the kind of science fiction ideas of Star Trek and so on. It'll take our Pioneer and Voyager probes on the order of 80,000 years to reach the nearest star, and they weren't sent deliberately to any other star. They're just cruising through space now. So really, in the foreseeable future, we're not going to be able to move anywhere else. And so scientists don't justify the search for planets in this way, but it is a natural thing to think about. The next question is, well, are we alone? We look for planets because perhaps this is where we could find neighbors in the cosmos to discover whether we're the only intelligent life. Astronomers refer to this search as SETI, search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and if you're going to look for other creatures in the universe, we expect to find them on the surface of a planet, not in interstellar space, not on the surface of a star where the temperatures and conditions aren't particularly hospitable to life. Now, most people, there are a lot of people who believe that we've already made contact with extraterrestrials. Now, this is a benign, this is from one of my favorite tabloids, the Weekly World News, which you can find if you're waiting in the checkout line at any supermarket in a major metropolitan center. These particular aliens are benign, although not all of us will agree with their musical taste. There are other aliens which are less benign, and apparently they've been visiting us for quite some time. Well, most astronomers don't believe that we've been visited by aliens because of the vast distances between the stars, and even with advanced technology, it's still not a walk in the park to come and visit us from neighboring stars. But many astronomers, I'd say most of us, believe that there is life out there, and probably intelligent life out there, and there is a program to try to eavesdrop on whether that life exists through radio telescopes. This is a giant radio dish in Puerto Rico in the valley called Arecibo, the largest single radio dish in the world, and it has been used and continues to be used to try to monitor signals from possibly other civilizations. Because any, and here we go, we'll see, we know that any civilization that uses TV or FM radio technology, that those signals leak through the atmosphere and will go out into space. And in fact, that's happening for ourselves. This plot here is if there were alien radio astronomers. This is a plot of the radio intensity and television signal intensity as a function of time over one 24-hour period that you would measure if you were on a planet orbiting one of our nearest neighboring stars called Barnard Star. And you see these peaks, which would repeat every 24 hours, or every 23 hours and 56 minutes, which is the Earth's rotation period. And the peaks come every time that something like the North American West Coast and East Coast and Japan and areas in Europe come on the horizon. Because we send our signals out along our own horizon so that other people on the Earth can listen to them. And so that's the way that they tend to beam out into space. And if there were alien radio astronomers monitoring this part of this direction where we are, they would see this signal and it would repeat again and again. We're not trying to signal them. They're just sort of, you know, picking up our leakage, and that's what we think we might be able to do. Now, if there is somebody out there on a star, then it could be bad news, because if there was a planetary system 36 light years away from us, they're receiving the pilot premiere episode of Gilligan's Island right about now. And that may explain why astronomers believe that we haven't been contacted by intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. But the final reason that we usually invoke is a much more down-to-earth reason, no pun intended. And The reason that we look for planetary systems around other stars is so that we have a better understanding of the planetary system in which we live, where our own home planet came from, and how it's going to evolve in the future. And up until very recently, we've only had one example of a planetary system, the solar system. And so our ideas and our theories about it have been very specifically modeled against that. And we'd like to know, how did the sun come about? How did the Earth and the other planets come about? The Earth is a pretty insignificant planet in the big scheme of things. Here's a plot just showing you the sun, and showing it the sun when it's giving off one of these very violent flares. Sun is approaching a maximum in its 11-year cycle, and so there are going to be more and more of those flares in the next few months and over the next year. And then shown the four largest planets of the solar system, which are giant gaseous bodies, shown to scale beside it, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Notice very carefully how an astronomer pronounces the name of that third large planet. And we've heard enough of those locker room jokes about, they found rings around Uranus and so on, so we say Uranus. And then that little dot, which I hope you can see there, is the Earth. That's the Earth as it would appear beside the sun and to scale beside the giant planets in the solar system. Keep this in mind, because these are the kinds of planets that we're capable of detecting right now. We're not at the level where we could look for something as small as the Earth. And so we want to know something about how we got here, testing our theories of the very birth of our star and its family of planets, including the Earth. And the leading theory, the one that explains most of the facts in the best way, is called the nebular hypothesis. And I think I have a cartoon here. Oh, there's just a family portrait, a sketch showing the solar system again, and now including not just the Earth, but Mercury, Venus, and Mars. Also relatively tiny, rocky, metallic bodies close to the sun, and so we call all four of these terrestrial planets, because in that characteristic, they're very similar to the Earth. And then there's tiny Pluto out here, which some planetary astronomers would say doesn't even deserve to be designated a planet, but we could talk about that after this talk. So what I want to do is kind of show you our theory. And our theory is called the nebular hypothesis. Nebula is just astro jargon for cloud. Anytime you hear an astronomer say the word nebula, it means a large cloud of gas and dust in space. And this is where we believe stars are being born. This is how we believe our own star, the sun, was born. Here's a typical such cloud here. It's pretty large, 15 light years across. If I was standing here with a flash camera and you were all over here and I wanted to take a Vancouver Institute group portrait, the moment the flash went off, it would take 15 years for it to travel there, another 15 years to bounce back to the camera. None of you had better have moved in the meantime, or you'll spoil the picture. This cloud is made up almost entirely of the simplest gases, simplest elements in the universe. Hydrogen, which is just a proton orbited by a single electron, and helium, which is two protons and two neutrons orbited by two electrons. And 98% of the universe by mass appears to be made of these two simple elements. Everything else, including things which are near and dear to our heart, like the iron and magnesium and silicon, which make up the planet beneath our feet, and the oxygen which we breathe in our atmosphere, and the nitrogen which is the main constituent of that atmosphere, and the carbon which makes up the organic molecules that make life itself possible on this planet, are all insignificant fractions of the composition of the universe, even more so if you think of them not by mass, but by number, because the more nuclei, the more particles you have in the nucleus of a heavy element, then the heavier it is. And so, in fact, hydrogen and helium make up about 99.8% of the composition of the sun, and in fact, overall, the composition of the solar system by number. So we really are made up of kind of the flotsam and jetsam, the leftovers in the universe. But this is the raw material from which we think the solar system was born. And here's a little cartoon set of panels to try to show you this picture. And I forgive me, I'm going to go through some sophisticated ideas and make them seem a little too simplistic for the sake of time. So you saw that thing before. This is my little representation of one of those clouds. That's why I'm an astronomer and not an artist. And it will begin to collapse under its own weight, under its own gravitational attraction. And as it begins to collapse, it will spin faster and faster because it started out with a little bit of rotation and it's going to pick up rotation. Now you might wonder, why should a cloud just floating in space have any rotation whatsoever? Well, it's partly because these clouds are orbiting around the center of our galaxy. They're obeying the laws of orbital mechanics, and so the part of the cloud closer to the center of the galaxy is moving faster than the part that's furthest away, and that imparts a little torque to this vast cloud. But also, if any of you are coffee or tea drinkers, and we do have coffee and tea after this talk, so there's some reason to stick around. If you are a coffee or tea drinker and you put milk or cream in your coffee, try this experiment. Take a cup and take a spoon full of coffee and stir it up as randomly as you can. And then pull the spoon out and drop in a dollop of milk or cream. And you'll notice that very soon, the milk or cream will begin to swirl around in one sense, counterclockwise or clockwise. The cylindrical walls of the coffee mug are kind of focusing the rather random turbulent motions in that fluid. And in this gaseous cloud, you have a three-dimensional gravitational pull, but any kind of turbulent motions will impart some net rotation. And that's going to speed up as this thing collapses due to conservation of angular momentum. Now, figure skaters intuitively know about conservation of angular momentum because they use it anytime they do one of these spectacular pirouettes. And let me show you here. I apologize for the resolution of this video, but here's a figure skater, and hopefully the technology works, is about to go through one of these pirouettes. And there we go. And so he's going to be spinning around with arms and legs extended. And then as he brings them in closer to his body, closer to the axis of rotation, spins faster and faster. Now, he doesn't have rocket packs on or anything that's giving him that. He's just taking advantage of the amount of angular momentum that he gave himself to begin with. And we can think of a figure skater, a rotating figure skater, and try to model the physics of it. And this is how an astronomer or a physicist would model that figure skater. shows that we got to get out more on Saturday nights. Unfortunately, these are all the salient points of that figure skater as far as a physicist is concerned. And essentially, the angular momentum, the spin momentum of any body is a function of how fast it's spinning, its mass, and its size, the distribution of where that mass is. And what you have to do is basically add up like the spin component of every point in this body, and I've kind of modeled this as a cylinder with two arms and mass points at the end. But what's happening is, if you can imagine bringing some of this mass in closer to the spin axis, the mass is not increasing on the figure skater unless somebody is, you know, throwing bags of Doritos at Eric Stoico or Elvis Stoico while he's doing this. So it might run this thing again just to show that. So as the arms are going in, more mass is coming closer to this rotation axis. The mass can't change, so the only thing that can change to keep this constant is the speed. And so if this goes down, that has to go up. And that's inexorable. And it happens, we see it with figure skaters, because there's not a lot of friction. The contact is with ice on a thin blade. We don't see it in most of our everyday lives because friction and air resistance tends to combat that. But there isn't any of that in space, and so as our cloud, which I've now simplified into this kind of egg, begins to collapse, it spins faster and faster, and it flattens out. The belly of the cloud is thrown out further by this rotational momentum. Anybody who's gone on an amusement park ride, you know, at Playland, on one of these things that twirls you around, or anybody who's taken their child or grandchild and grabbed them by the arms and twirled them around like that, knows the effect that rotational momentum can have to counter gravity. And so gravity, which is trying to bring everything in towards the center, is resisted along the equator of the spin, and so this thing flattens out into something that looks a bit like a flying saucer. Gotta keep those alien themes in here just to justify the title. And most of the stuff is accumulating in here, and that's where the sun is going to form. That's where the star is going to form, which represents, you know, more than 99% of the mass of the solar system. Out here in the cooler parts of the cloud, where there's less stuff accumulating, that's where the planets are going to condense. And we can actually use supercomputers to simulate this process. And here's a computer simulation of a planet about the mass of Jupiter, which is condensed out of one of these clouds. And the sun here, the colors are meant to represent temperature. The proto-sun is forming at the center. That's where it's going to reach temperatures of millions of degrees. If we look down on this, then basically what we formed is all the planets are orbiting in a thin disk, in roughly circular orbits, and all in the same sense. For our solar system, counterclockwise is seen from above the North Pole of the Earth, if you went high enough up into space above the sun and planets. And sure enough, most of the planets that we see have roughly circular orbits, with the prominent exception of Pluto. And we believe that Pluto has undergone a rather strange, chaotic interaction with Neptune to get its wonky orbit. But then Pluto is such an insignificant little chunk of ice and rock that we don't really worry about it in the context of this overall nebular hypothesis. You will see in here, here's the orbit of a famous comet, Halley's Comet, which comes back to the inner solar system every 76 years. And you can see it has a very elongated orbit. But the planets, the large mass of things in our solar system, do not have these. They're almost circles. They're actually ellipses, but at this scale, they're almost indistinguishable from circles. And the nebular hypothesis has a good explanation for that. You know, why don't we have planets that orbit this way and this way at the same time, the way you might picture electrons orbiting around an atom? Well, this is why we think that's the case. And why is it that we have massive, gigantic gaseous bodies, gas giant planets in the outer solar system, and tiny metallic rocky ones in the inner solar system? Well, that cloud is hot closer to the proto-sun when it's forming. The temperatures are up in around 1,000 to 2,000 Kelvin. Kelvin is just a temperature scale relative to absolute zero, the coldest thing that you can have if you've removed all of the kinetic energy, all of the emotional energy out of the particles in something. And so if you want to convert this to Celsius, all you have to do is subtract 273. So this is about 220 degrees below zero Celsius. That's about 170 degrees below zero Celsius. This is about room temperature, right about here. And it turns out that the things that make up the inner planets condense out of this cloud, are able to condense out of this cloud at temperatures like this. Whereas the ices and things that dominate the moons and the comets and the cores probably of these giant gaseous planets can condense in the cool outskirts of this cloud. Then finally, at the center, the pressure and the temperature have built up enough that thermonuclear reactions can be triggered. And by definition, to an astronomer, that's when a star is born. That's when the proto-sun became a star, became the sun as we know it. There's an intense blast of radiation and solar wind, we believe, gases flowing away from that young star, which basically sweeps away the rest of the leftover gas from this nebular disk. And this is kind of just a dramatic artist's conception of that. It probably looked nothing like that, but it was a pretty picture. I couldn't resist putting it up. So this is our picture of where we think we came from. The problem is, of course, is that we only have one example of that. And so it works well to explain a lot of features in the solar system. The other nice thing about it is that we do see examples of the nebular hypothesis in action in other parts of our galaxy. And you don't have to look any further than if you go outside tonight, and if it stays clear, you should be able to look in the southern sky and see this group of stars called Orion, the Hunter. Three stars that make up the belt, two stars in the shoulders. This particular one is a red supergiant called Betelgeuse, which is from the ancient Arabic for the hairy armpit of the giant, which is appropriate. And then the stars in his tunic, and this is Rigel. That's a street lamp, by the way. That's not a UFO. And dangling beneath Orion's belt is his sword. That's our story, and astronomers are sticking to it. We call that Orion's sword. And if you take a closer look, in fact, if you were to look at Orion not with the kind of light that we see with the eye, but at radio and infrared wavelengths, we find that there's all sorts of this gas, these clouds, in this region. Not all of them are glowing, but the thing that makes up Orion's sword is glowing because of young stars that are forming in it. And here's a magnified view of what we call the Orion Nebula. You can actually see this with the telescope that we have on campus, the roof of the Geophysics and Astronomy Building. It was open earlier this evening. And if there are people after reception that are still interested and it's clear, I could take a group over there to the observatory. But you won't see all of these colors. It'll look kind of grayish-green to the eye, but you will be able to see this cloud with your own eyes. And the Hubble Space Telescope has given us views inside this cloud, looking at some of these collapsing protostellar, protoplanetary disks which are forming. This is about the size of the Pluto's orbit, by the way, just for comparison in these pictures. I apologize, that didn't turn out quite as clearly as I'd hoped. There are many such clouds in the galaxy. This is one referred to as the Eagle Nebula. It's supposed to look like an eagle. That's kind of the body. Those are the wings. It looks to me like a scrawny chicken. But scrawny chicken nebula just doesn't have the same panache as Eagle Nebula. But the Hubble Space Telescope took a spectacular view of the upper portions of this nebula, reoriented here. And this is another basically stellar maternity ward, where at the tips of these gigantic clouds, we believe that small clouds are condensing and forming stellar, and we presume, planetary systems even as I speak. Here's an example of some of these clouds that have collapsed down. They've gotten so dense that they block out the light from the stars behind them. And in fact, we even see other examples of disks. Here we've blocked out artificially the light from the bright star so that we can see here in false color, the yellow represents emission from dust, which has been flattened out into a rotating disk. And in fact, we can make measurements which tell us that that part is moving towards us and that part's moving away from us, that the whole thing is revolving around, orbiting around a common center the way the nebular hypothesis predicts. We even know, thanks to radio telescopes, and one of my colleagues, Bill McCutcheon, is here in the audience tonight, and he's a world expert on using radio information on star-forming clouds like this to determine their conditions inside, including their composition. And radio astronomers have found a variety of molecules, including organic molecules, in interstellar clouds to show us that we, in fact, have the building blocks for life out there if this hypothesis is correct, including things like amino acids, which have been detected. This one, any chemists out there who can tell me what this last molecule happens to be? It's one that's near and dear to my heart. Any guesses?
Ethanol.
Exactly, that's ethyl alcohol. And it turns out that in one of these star-forming clouds, one that's close in the direction of the center of our galaxy, there's quite a bit of ethyl alcohol out there. And in fact, when this announcement was made, when NASA radio astronomers, I think, had a press release on this, apparently, and I don't know if this is a true story, but apparently a Texas distilling billionaire wanted to buy the distilling rights to the Sagittarius B2 cloud from NASA. And if NASA had been smart, I think they would have sold this person the rights for whatever he was willing to pay, because although there's a tremendous amount of alcohol in this cloud, it's very thinly dispersed. And you know, if you were pushing a funnel a kilometer across around at a good fraction of the speed of light for a millennium, you still wouldn't get enough alcohol to make one single decently dry martini. So, but the important thing is that the raw materials are out there to build things like the Earth and to build things like us if you can bring them together in the right way. So that's really the reason why we want to look out, because we can see young stars. This is a cluster called the Pleiades, which you can see with the naked eye. You can probably see it tonight, too, if it stays clear. These are young baby stars, maybe only a few tens or hundreds of millions of years old. which sounds pretty old to you and me, but we keep in mind that we believe the sun is just entering middle age at about 4.5 billion years. So these really are toddlers. And I've turned the slide around sideways from the way it's normally shown because they kind of make a question mark when you see it this way. And the question mark up until 5 years ago was that we saw every step of the nebular hypothesis played out in the galaxy around us except one, and that was the formation of planets. We had as yet not detected planets. So how do you do that? How do you find a planet around one of these pinpoints of light? And it's a challenging thing to do. The Hubble Space Telescope has tried to look for faint stars around planets. Our space probes, like the Voyager 2 probe, which explored the outer solar system and then its own momentum continued to carry it into space, has left the solar system. Its cameras were turned around, and it took pictures of some of the planets in our own solar system, including the Earth. This band here is dust, which is in the plane of the Earth's orbit, which is reflecting sunlight, scattering sunlight. We call this the zodiacal light. But notice how insignificant these little specks of dot. The Earth really is a pale blue dot, as seen even from the fairly near vantage point of just outside our solar system. What about the vantage point from yet another solar system? You know, how are you going to find a tiny little star lost in the, or a planet lost in the glare of that star? The Hubble Space Telescope has taken very highly magnified and very high resolution images of stars and has discovered faint companions around them, things that aren't quite stars, but they aren't planets either. They're what we call brown dwarfs, kind of a failed star, a big ball of gas which hasn't quite reached the mass to trigger those nuclear reactions to make them burst into life as a star. This is just a faint star, actually would be much fainter than the sun, just looks bright in this overexposed image, and this is just an artifact of the telescope optics and the space telescope structure. It's not a jet leaving from this star. If you wanted to take a picture of a planet around another star, imagine trying to photograph a mosquito fluttering around a 100-watt light bulb. Except you're not standing near the 100-watt bulb. You're not even on the outskirts of the city, which has the 100-watt bulb. You're 20 or 30 kilometers away from the 100-watt bulb, and you want to photograph that mosquito. And that's even a piece of cake compared to what we need to do, because the mosquito is much larger and brighter in comparison to the bulb than a planet would be in comparison to the sun. Even Jupiter, the largest planet in our solar system, would be a billion times fainter than the sun in a photograph taken from another star system. The Earth would be about 5 billion times fainter. You can improve this a little bit by taking pictures not in the kind of light that we see with the eye, but in infrared wavelengths where the sun is less bright and planets, which are cool, give off more radiation. But even so, it's a challenging thing, and the space telescope and existing telescopes on the Earth right now are just not capable of doing that. So instead, what we try to do is see how does the planet affect the star? Let me just check to see where I am in terms of slides. Okay, not doing too badly here. We tend to think of our solar system as the sun at the center and all the planets revolving around it, and the sun is fixed at the center. But if you think about it, that can't quite be true, because there's nothing in space to nail down a body. You know, the sun can't just be attached. attached to a certain, the idea was just so amazing that I had to cough over it. Attached to a certain part of space. Newton's third law is often phrased as, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The forces which the sun exerts on planets, the planets are also exerting on the sun in equal measure. It's just that the sun is so much more massive that it doesn't respond, it doesn't accelerate as much as the planets do. But in reality, if you were to think of a planet like Jupiter, which is by far the most massive planet in the solar system, but is only a thousandth of the mass of the sun, as Jupiter revolves around the sun at once every 12 years, the sun is also forced to revolve around a common point, which we call the center of mass. It's like the concept of center of gravity or balance. And that point is 1,000 times closer to the center of the sun than it is to Jupiter. It turns out that it's right on the edge of the sun. And so what the sun does, due to Jupiter, is to wobble around on its edge once every 12 years. Now, if we were again alien astronomers looking down on the solar system, oops, from a distance. And we were to keep track of the position of the sun, we would see that it makes this subtle wobble. Now, it's not just a circular wobble because there's more than just Jupiter in our solar system. The other planets also contribute to this center of mass motion. And so this is tracking starting from 1960, and the sun makes these little loop-de-loops. It's almost like the figure skating exercises up until 2025. And this is how things would look from a distance of about 33 light years above the solar system. The important thing here, though, is the scale. From here to here is an angle that astronomers would refer to as a milliarcsecond, a thousandth of a second of arc. That's about a 4 millionth of a degree. So the sun, as would appear in the sky to these observers, would be wobbling back and forth by about a 4 millionth of a degree. Just to put that in perspective, if you pause for a moment and you look around you and look at somebody who's about 2 meters or 6 feet away from you and look at them and then close your eyes for a second and open your eyes again. In that 1 second that your eyes were closed when you were looking at that person's head, a follicle of hair on that person's head will have grown. And in your field of view, it will have grown by 1 milliarcsecond. That's the kind of angle that you have to measure. Amazingly enough, in some circumstances, we are able to measure angles that small, but not in terms of measuring the wobble of other stars. So we could instead look at the situation sideways. Let's say we weren't looking down on the solar system, but we were looking at it on edge. And the sun is moving away from us and towards us. And so if we could measure this changing speed of the sun, and this is just showing how the speed of the sun would change, and this is mostly every 12 years, this is covering the same 1960 to 2025, this change in speed is about 100 kilometers per hour, which is easy enough for us to measure on the Earth, but very hard for us to measure in stars. But basically, if we could measure it, then we could detect an unseen planet because of this reflex motion induced in the visible star. And here's a little, just a cartoon showing that in a different way from perspective. So you could be looking down on it and seeing, you don't see the planet in reality, it's too faint. So all you see is the star going around like this, or you see the star moving back towards you and away from you as you observe. Oops. And how would we measure this? Well, we measure it the same way that the police and the BC government knew, and I'm sorry I put this in backwards, I knew I had to do that for one, that my colleague, who shall remain nameless, but it wasn't Bill McCutcheon, by the way, who's in the audience, was going 65 kilometers per hour in a 50 kilometer per hour zone, because he was caught at a photo radar trap. And this is Doppler radar. What's happening is there's a radar unit that's sending out radio waves, which are of known frequency or wavelength. They bounce off the receding bumper of the vehicle, and the echo that's received is shifted in wavelength or in frequency by that motion. And here's just a little cartoon. This works for any waves. It works for sound waves, works for water waves, and it works for light waves. And so if we can measure the change in the wavelength of light coming from a star, we can measure how fast it's moving away from us or towards us. We call this the Doppler effect, and this is one of the few equations, the only other equation I'm going to show tonight, that just shows that if we can measure that change in wavelength relative to what you would see if there was no motion at all, then you can measure what's called the radial velocity. That's the component of the motion along your line of sight. If something's moving at right angles to you, you're not going to see any shift. If it's moving directly away from you or towards you, this would be its total speed. If it's moving at some angle, this would be some fraction of its total speed relative to the speed of light, which is 300,000 kilometers per second. Now, we experience the Doppler effect in our everyday lives. If you're on a highway or an ambulance goes past and you hear the siren or the engine or whatever going, kind of effect, where the pitch of the sound starts out at it goes from a high pitch to a low pitch. as it's at higher frequencies when it's moving towards you, lower frequencies when it's moving away from you. Now, a lot of people, I think, intuitively understand the Doppler effect, and they think that it applies to light in our everyday lives, because I see it on the streets of Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto, Italy, everywhere in the world. People, when they're approaching a traffic light and it turns yellow, they hit the accelerator. And they must realize that they must be thinking that if they move fast enough, they can Doppler shift the yellow light to a shorter wavelength and turn it to green. Well, you can use this formula to calculate that, to shift yellow light to green light. And it turns out that if you plug in the appropriate numbers, you get something which is about 9% of the speed of light. That's 97 million kilometers per hour. Even in Quebec, they don't drive that fast. I can tell you, having lived there. The reason why we experience the Doppler effect with sound is because things in our everyday lives travel at speeds comparable to the speed of sound. Very few things in our lives travel at speeds comparable to the speed of light. But stars do, and astronomers are able to measure very small changes in starlight. Let me just check to see where we are here. Yeah. And how do we do that? Basically, we have to take what we want to do is we want to see whether the light is changing in a regular way, going from shorter to longer wavelength as this wobbling star moves towards us and then away from us due to an invisible planet. Well, when we're not working with sound you can hear the pitch of light. How do you tell that the pitch of, that we can hear the pitch of sound? How do we tell that the pitch of light is changing? Here's a picture of the sun. We can basically use a prism, or in the case of astronomy, we use what's called a diffraction grating, a piece of reflective metal with up to, in this case, 1,800 grooves machined into this in every millimeter. There are 1,800 grooves per millimeter, and it produces a spectrum, just like if you look at a CD, the light reflected from a CD. And we can see kind of the rainbow spectrum of sunlight and starlight, but we also see that there are dark lines superimposed on that if we look in enough detail. And these, oops, sorry. Told you I was going to have trouble walking and chewing gum at the same time. These dark lines are the signature, the kind of the barcodes of stars. They're the signature that tell us which elements are there, what their temperature is. That's where we know about the fact that hydrogen and helium dominate the sun and other stars. Now, we don't usually take pictures of them, as we do here, in which these things have been labeled according to the elements and the ions that they represent. We usually use digital equipment, and each one of those dark lines corresponds to a dip in the amount of light from the star, and each one of those dips corresponds to a different element. And so we can basically, with using a digital detector, kinds of things which are developed and built right here at UBC, and we're building them for our space telescope project as well, you can produce basically little signposts in the light of a star, because we know at what wavelength a certain thing like this line, chromium 1 line, occurs. We know where it occurs in the laboratory. We measure where it occurs in the starlight, and we can see how much it's changed and translate that change into a velocity. Now, this is a hard thing to do. And up until 10 years ago, well, 15 years ago, the best that astronomers could do would be to measure star speeds to about a precision of 3,600 kilometers per hour. But thanks to techniques that were pioneered here at UBC, Gordon Walker, previous speaker in the Vancouver Institute series, and Bruce Campbell at the time at UVic, I apologize I didn't capitalize the V there, started the first search for planets around other sun-like stars using a technique that they developed that allowed us to measure these wavelengths more accurately, more precisely than ever before. This is Dr. Walker right here at our campus telescope, which you can visit on clear Saturday nights, testing some equipment. And they developed a scheme where the starlight was actually passed through a cell of gas. And the gas would put in little signposts, its own little absorption features. as a kind of like a ruler built into every measurement. And so if your telescope flexed or the instrument temperature changed or the something else happened in your instrument, that would tell you, and you could remove that and see what was truly happening in the star. And this improved our ability to measure Doppler shifts in stars by more than an order of magnitude. The problem is the gas, as you can kind of get hinted at by this danger acid equipment sign, which we've tried to cover up, was hydrogen fluoride, which turns out to be one of the deadliest substances known to man. A few molecules, a few parts per billion of this is enough into your system to produce things like hydrochloric and hydrofluoric acid in your lungs and kill you in a horrible death. But it turned out to be a very good ruler for spectroscopy, and so astronomers' science is our master and mistress. So away we went with hydrogen fluoride cells to survey a couple of dozen stars in what we call the solar neighborhood, our neck of the woods in the galaxy. But Vancouver or Victoria is not the optimum location to do this kind of search for weather and other reasons. So we went to what was, of course, a much better location. We went to Hawaii. And we went to Hawaii for the obvious reasons. It's one of the best places to observe the skies. Well, before you feel too jealous, this is not our Hawaii on the big island of Hawaii itself. This is our Hawaii up here on the summit of Mauna Kea, the world's tallest volcano, at an altitude of 4,200 meters, 14,000 feet. And you see some little flecks of white up there in this picture, if you look carefully. This is the astronomers' Hawaii, at least at this time of the year. No one believes that there's a place that's cold and snowy in Hawaii, but there is. This is the summit of Mauna Kea, where the air pressure is about half that at sea level, so people suffer from hypoxia and altitude sickness. You get ice storms like this. You get winds that go up to 150 kilometers per hour. This was a fairly calm day. It was only 130. But you also have one of the best vantage points on the surface of the Earth, if not the best vantage point, to observe the heavens above the cloud deck, above half of the Earth's atmosphere. And countries around the world have built some of the largest and most advanced telescopes on this mountain perch. And Canada is among them. This is the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope. This telescope was what was used for the planet survey. Here's the telescope itself. There's a colleague, I believe that's Harvey Richer, in there posing beside the telescope. Oh, the slide's coming out of there. And the light, this is a 3.6 meter diameter telescope. It has a mirror, an eye 3.6 meters across. The light is fed down to an instrument, a spectrograph, which was equipped with this hydrogen fluoride cell, and there's that diffraction grating that you saw before, turning the starlight into evidence for planets. There were some tantalizing false alarms, and as it's turned out after the fact, one of the stars they observed did show the signature of what may be a planet. And in fact, we're now looking back at that, and it's possible that the very first evidence for a planet around another star, like the Sun, was from this survey. But no announcements were made. In the meantime, other groups of astronomers working from Dr. Walker's and Dr. Campbell's and their collaborators' work and adapting these ideas started their own searches. And one of these searches was conducted by a group of Geneva astronomers working both from the Southern Hemisphere, the European Southern Observatory in the Andes Mountains of Chile, and also from the Geneva Observatory in Switzerland. And they started one of these Doppler searches as well. And they didn't have the same precision as the Canadian search, but they were looking at different stars in a different way. And they happened to be looking in this direction of the sky. This is the constellation Pegasus, the flying horse. And I think the shape of the flying horse should be obvious to all of you there. If it's not, here's just a little thing to guide your eye. There you go. Should be pretty obvious there. Oops. Yeah, I think you can see that now. Well, here's another map. Actually, don't worry, I don't see any of the whales and flying horses and fairy princesses that are supposedly up in the sky. I'm personally convinced that the first people who named the constellations were also the first people to ferment wine and experiment with magic mushrooms. But you can see what we call the Great Square of Pegasus, this kind of trapezoid, also visible in the evening winter skies of Vancouver. And the Geneva team, Michel Mayor and his collaborators, were looking at this star with the innocuous catalog name of 51 Pegasi. And when they looked at 51 Pegasi, they detected a set of a wobble. But the surprise was that we were looking for a wobble in planets that would have periods of years or decades, like Jupiter in our own solar system that goes around the sun every 12 years. Instead, they found a wobble with a period of 4 days, a little more than 4 days, which was totally unexpected. If you translate that into the distance of the planet from the star, you can literally show the star and the planet to scale on the same diagram. This planet, if it would be that big and that close to its star. And if you remember how big Jupiter was and how far away Jupiter is from the sun, this is incredible. And the astronomers usually can't even hope to put planets and stars on the same scale, on the same diagram. Let me show you the kind of wobble that we're looking at here, if this animation will work. So this is kind of a representation of the star 51 Pegasi and its companion, 51 Pegasi B. We haven't given it anything more poetic. Taking a little while here, but hopefully, there we go. And so you can see, we don't see the planet, we just see the wobble of the star, and now we're just looking at another plane, and I finished this up where the planet's between us and the star, so it looks like a donut. Seemed like an appropriate Canadian thing to end up on. So basically, here we go, I'm getting ahead of myself again. But this was really weird. I mean, in fact, Dr. Walker and I were asked to review the original work and before it was published. And although we couldn't find any errors in it, it seemed remarkable that a planet the size of Jupiter could exist that close to its star, that we thought there must be some other explanation, or maybe this is some kind of weird oddball. But at the same time, another group, again adapting the precise radial velocity techniques pioneered here in BC, now using telescopes at the Lick Observatory in California, including this one, a 3-meter reflector, and using telescopes on Mauna Kea as well, the largest telescopes in the world, the Keck giants. Here's the Keck telescope from the air with the dome open. That's the mirror, which is basically a jigsaw of 36 hexagonal mirrors put together to make a giant mirror. Just to give you a sense of scale, there's a technician posing in the central hole of this mosaic mirror, which is effectively 10 meters across. They started to find wobbles in other stars, also with very short periods. Here's one with only 3-day period. See the speeds here, like, you know, kind of conventional earthly speeds, 180 kilometers per hour. That's a snail's pace for a star. And so this particular signal meant that this would be a Jupiter-type planet that was orbiting well inside the orbit of Mercury in our own solar system, which is totally at odds with what we expected from the nebular hypothesis. The Jeff Marcy and Paul Butler's survey has also found a system that appears to have more than one planet. So now it's not just one simple little wobble, there's a whole bunch of wobbles. This is a computer representation of what it would be like to be in that system with 3 different stars orbiting around the star Upsilon Andromedae. And here are the orbits of those 3 planets, including one tiny little circle that you can barely see close to the star. The dashed lines are the orbits of Mercury, Venus, the Earth, and Mars. One thing you notice is that these things, which are giant planets, are orbiting very close to their star, but you'll also notice that they have kind of wonky Pluto-like orbits. They have these very eccentric orbits, which we don't see for the massive planets in our own solar system. And if you were to compare these systems with our solar system, now the size of the star and the planets are not to scale, but the distances are in proportion. There's Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. The planet Jupiter is 5 astronomical units. An astronomical unit, or AU, is just the term we use for the distance between the Earth and the Sun, 150 million kilometers. So Jupiter is not even on the scale. I can't even keep it in the lecture hall. It's, you know, it's 5 units away, so it's way out over there. And look at all these kind of things that are even 10 times the mass of Jupiter, and maybe more, orbiting very close to their star, orbiting inside the orbit of Mercury, where they should not exist, according to the nebular hypothesis. Let me just check to see where we are here. There we go. Oops, I'll leave that up for a moment. Well, to be honest, I was skeptical that these things were really planets. They were so bizarre. They seemed to fly in the face of everything we knew. I was pretty much convinced that something in the star was mimicking this wobble, because stars can pulsate and they have spots which are carried by rotation, which could fool you into thinking that you're seeing the star moving around due to an orbit. But pretty much even I was convinced that these things were planets when one of them passed between us and the star. This kind of thing happens in our solar system. It happened last year with Mercury. This is the silhouette of Mercury as it's just skimming past the disk of the Sun, as seen by a space satellite called TRACE. This is Mercury right here, this little dot passing in front of the disk of the Sun during another transit. And you can imagine that if you were another alien astronomer looking at the Sun and something passed in front of it like this, that the brightness of the star would drop by a little amount. And in fact, we can measure that for large planets. So as the planet passes in front of the star, we don't get to see this. We don't get to see this magnified view. All we do is measure the brightness, which stays steady, steady, and then dips down. And then when the planet reemerges, or, you know, passes from in front of the star again, and we see the full starlight, it goes back to normal. And that was measured, in fact, by an expatriate Canadian, David Charbonneau, who might be coming back to Vancouver to work with us for the first time, and pretty much showed that these, at least some of these systems, really were planets. And this is an artist's conception of that transit of this particular system, which is HD 20649, if I remember right. I've got more important things than remembering catalog numbers in my head. One of the real mysteries is that not only are these planets big and orbiting close to their parent stars, but they have these very elongated orbits as well. Again, the dynamics are very different than what we see in our solar system, and that's what you're seeing, a whole bunch of these orbits just overplotted, and you can see how many of them are egg-shaped with the Sun at one focus near one edge. This would be totally different than the situation that we see for our own solar system. Pluto is the only one that has that kind of characteristic. We can model some of these characteristics. These are actually some supercomputer simulations by another expatriate Canadian, and Brad Hansen and colleagues, showing one of these nebular disks and showing how things like Jupiter can form within them. We're pretty much sure that these planets could not form where they are now. It's very unlikely, if not impossible. So what we believe is happening is that they're forming out where Jupiter is in our own solar system, and then they are migrating inwards. They're losing orbital energy, perhaps because they're interacting with the disk from which they formed, and moving in closer to their parent star. And so this migration hypothesis is the main most accepted theory right now. Oops, there we go. Now you might wonder, really, we're only able to see giant planets. We're biased towards the most massive ones. We're not sensitive to anything less massive than, say, Uranus at the moment. And the shorter periods are the ones we can see most easily. And we certainly can't detect anything like the Earth at present. So, you know, why should we get all excited? Why should there be headlines like this saying, is our solar system a rarity in the great beyond? And what does this say about life in other planetary systems? Well, it could say quite a bit. Here's another one of these diagrams showing our solar system And again, now we're on a scale. This is a logarithmic scale, so that you can actually include, Jupiter almost fits into this one. And some of these other systems, and showing where the planets are located relative to Mercury, Venus, Mars, and the Earth and Mars. And the green zone here represents what we've called the habitable zone. That's where liquid water can exist easily in the surface. Closer than that, in this region, then what happens is you have a runaway greenhouse effect, like in Venus, which is very similar to the Earth in many respects, but whose atmosphere is totally inhospitable to life because of a runaway greenhouse effect. The surface temperature on Venus now exceeds the melting temperature of lead. And out here, where water freezes, and so you wouldn't have Earth-like conditions. So a lot of these systems actually do occur in a region where liquid water could exist, but these arrows here represent where their orbits carry them. And notice a lot of them, sometimes they're far enough out to be at the right temperature, but a lot of them bring them in to very close proximity to their stars. So these probably wouldn't be great places to look for life as we know it. The other thing is that if there are planets that were forming out here, and there were planets like the Earth in this habitable zone, as they migrated in, they would have swept up any of those habitable planets and destroyed them. So we should be grateful that we live in a solar system that in which Jupiter stayed out where it is. So it's perhaps we are rare in the universe, and we're not just a ghetto that's shunned by aliens, but that maybe there aren't that many systems that are habitable as we thought. Now, even though the planets themselves are gigantic, they're gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn or larger, we would never think of looking for Earth-type life in such a gas giant system. But these planets have moons around them, and many of those moons are the sizes of worlds, of planets themselves in their own right if they were orbiting around the Sun. Here's Jupiter as imaged by the Voyager spacecraft. This is Io and Europa, two of the four largest moons, which you could see with our telescope here on campus, although they would look just like little stars as opposed to resolved disks. And Europa has achieved a lot of attention, received a lot of attention lately. It's an icy world, but there's evidence that beneath the ice there might be a liquid water ocean, and perhaps this could be an abode for life. And these giant planets around other stars, if they exist, and if they're at the right distance and in a stable circular orbit, could have moons that are large enough to be considered terrestrial worlds. Here's the Earth and Venus in our own solar system. There's Europa, Ganymede, some of the large moons of Jupiter, and you can see that they start to rival our planet in size. In fact, Ganymede is bigger than the planet Mercury. And so moons of these systems could, in principle, be a place where we might look for life. First, we have to find out whether there are moons there at all. We have to get better observations, and there are a lot of other things. So this is conjecture. We do know that we find these systems everywhere in the sky, and now there are about 50 of them known. It's quite possible that a lot of them aren't planets. It's quite possible that a lot of them are just faint stars or these brown dwarfs, because one of the problems with the Doppler technique is that we don't know which way the orbits are tilted. And if we're looking at the orbit edge on, then we're getting the true mass of the planet. But if we're looking at the orbit at a high angle, then we're only getting a lower limit on the mass of the planet. And it's possible, in fact, it's suspected by a number of astronomers now, that many of these systems may be seen at a very high angle, and so that they may not be planets, they may just be conventional stars. But it's clear that some of these, like 51 Pegasi and so on, cannot be explained that way, and that they're almost certainly some kind of alien world, some kind of exotic planetary system. And here's a nice artist conception. We have no idea what these things look like yet, but we certainly are hoping to make observations that will tell us about that. Here's a planet in our own solar system, Saturn. It turns out that this planet that's depicted here would have a minimum mass about that of Saturn, and so that's why the artist gave it rings, because, of course, any planet that's like Saturn has to have rings, but there's no evidence for rings whatsoever, but it makes for a pretty picture. And let me just finally sum up, because I said in the last slide here, over here, that they're everywhere. But what they're everywhere in our sky as seen from the Earth. But we haven't searched a very big part of our galaxy or the universe. If you look up at night on a clear, dark night away from the city lights, you can see the glow of the Milky Way. And what you're seeing is the combined light from the other stars, several hundred billion stars, that make up our Milky Way galaxy. And here's a panoramic picture showing the entire Milky Way across the entire sky in a mosaic. And if we could get outside of our galaxy, our galactic city, we would see something like this. In fact, it's a flattened disk, very much like what we think the protoplanetary nebula was like. In fact, the formation mechanism for galaxies on an enormous scale may have a lot of things in common with the formation process for stars and planets. And if you were to look at the kind of intergalactic mall map of you are here we are on the edge of our galactic city, we're a suburb, we're the Surrey of our galaxy, out in the outskirts, here's the center. And just like if you're in the outskirts and you look towards the downtown core, you can see the glow of the city lights. That's what we see when we look in space and we see the Milky Way. We're something like 25 or 30,000 light years from the downtown core in this flattened disk, orbiting around the center once every 250 million years. And all of the stars that we've been searching, that I've been telling you about, all are in a tiny little volume of space around here, what we call the solar neighborhood. And so we've only really just scratched the surface. So, you know, there's a lot to be done. And of course, this is just one galaxy. Our Milky Way galaxy is one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the observable universe. The Hubble Space Telescope has taken a probe of a very thin section of the sky. If you hold up your finger at arm's length, be very careful which finger you hold up so you don't offend anyone near you, but if you hold up, let's say, your index finger at arm's length and look at your fingernail, that covers a certain field of vision in your view. This picture covers about a tenth of the width of your fingernail as seen at arm's length. And in it, all of these blobs of light you see are other galaxies. There's only about 9 stars in this picture. Everything else is a galaxy which on average contains maybe 100 billion or more stars. And we've really only begun this kind of search. And the question is, eventually we hope to find out whether there are other places that look like this elsewhere in the universe. I really appreciate your patience, and I've only been able to really scratch the surface of an exciting topic. So if you're interested in keeping pace with things, you can check out these websites, for planet searches, and also check out the UBC astronomy and physics websites where other developments, including links to some of these things, are accessible, and information about how to come to our observatory on a Saturday night. So you can keep up to date, and if by some long shot you're actually still interested after hearing me talk for, more than my hour that I was allotted, I apologize, you can certainly keep pace with developments there. Thank you for being a very patient and attentive audience. I won't be offended if people have to leave, because I know that I'm running over time, but I'm certainly happy to stick around. I'll bring up the lights and answer any immediate questions that you might have. And I'll let our chair keep everybody, including me, under control.
Well, since Dr. Matthews has a great deal of information, we will entertain short and pertinent questions. And I mean short.
But I can't guarantee the answers will be short.
No. You can have all the time you like for the answers.
Yes, in the white shirt. So the question is that these giant planets made of gas orbiting, hugging in 20 times closer than the Earth is to the Sun, they couldn't have formed there. It's very hard for us to understand how something could form like that there, that they had to form out where Jupiter is in our own solar system and move there. And we believe it's the same kind of process in some sense that we see in our own solar system. I mentioned briefly that we think that Pluto was distorted into its current eccentric orbit by what's called a chaotic interaction, a resonance with the orbit of Neptune. And it turns out that planets, although they're far apart from one another, and although they're not physically connected, their gravitational interactions can be quite powerful. For example, in the Earth-Moon system, the reason why the moon always keeps the same side to us, the familiar face of the man in the moon or the rabbit that you see, the familiar side of the moon spins around on its axis the same time it takes to go around the Earth. It didn't start that way. It would have been spinning much faster when it was formed, however it was formed, and it's been slowed down by the tides of the Earth that locked it into this kind of synchronized ballet with us. The moon is exerting tides on the Earth. We know that from the effects of the oceans. And it's also attempting to slow down the Earth, and it is, but it's taking a long time. And the Earth is gradually rotating more and more slowly, and the moon is spiraling away from the Earth to keep everything in balance through conservation of angular momentum, same principle I talked about before, until eventually we'll reach an equilibrium where the Earth will spin around in the same amount of time as the moon takes to go around the Earth. The month would be longer, and the day would be something like 47 times the length of the current day, and the moon would always hang over the same point in the Earth all the time. And so those kinds of dynamical interactions between planets, and if you start to add in the gas and dust from a protoplanetary disk, can actually lead to planets moving from their orbits, not just moving outwards, but also moving inwards. And planetary theorists, after these initial results were released, kind of went, oh yeah, we could have told you that that happened. Yeah, well, duh. Well, thanks for telling us now. So there are plausible mechanisms for how this could happen. Now, the question is, why didn't it happen in our solar system? And it may be just the critical timing of, remember I showed you that slide of when the leftover gas was blasted away by the formation of the star bursting into life. And the timing of that could be critical. If, in our case, Jupiter and the giant planets may have formed, and then very quickly everything was dispersed, so there was no more opportunity for interaction. It's possible that in most other systems that the timing isn't quite so fortuitous, and that the disk sticks around long enough for these planets to lose energy and spiral in towards their stars. But if you check out the second website there, which is the Extrasolar Planet Encyclopedia, you can actually go to links which discuss some of these migration theories. There was a nice article in Scientific American in 1999 by Rama Malhotra on planet migration in our own solar system and in other systems as well, if you can check that out. I warned you that they wouldn't be short answers. Yes, you're there with the hat. Okay. It's a little bit, but yeah, I will repeat the question, and it's one you hear a lot. It's a little far afield from alien worlds. The question is that when I show these pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope looking at galaxies further and further out into space, and I talk about the observable universe, is there an edge to the universe? You know, and if there is, what's on the other side? Is that pretty much what you're asking? Well, what we call the observable universe is as far as we can see since the universe was created. Astronomers believe most of the observations point to the fact that the universe was created in something that we call the Big Bang, maybe 15 billion years ago, but there's some debate about when that happened. But the point is that if that's what's happened, it doesn't matter how big the universe is. If there is a galaxy which is 16 billion light years away, the light hasn't had a chance to get to us yet because the universe has only been around for, say, 15 billion years. So our horizon, what we can observe in the universe, is limited by the time it's taken light to travel to us from other parts of the universe. So it's possible that the universe could go on forever and ever beyond that, although most astronomers don't believe that. But we also don't believe that there's an edge. We believe that our universe, our three dimensions of space, are actually curved around in themselves, that the space-time geometry is curved in such a way that we have a finite volume in three dimensions, but no edge. Like if you could imagine that there were two-dimensional creatures living in a two-dimensional universe that were unaware of the third dimension, and they lived on the surface of a balloon. That balloon could be blown up and expanding. Every point on the surface of that balloon moves away from every other point, just as like we see in our three-dimensional universe as the universe expands. None of them are at the center of the expansion. The center of the expansion is in the third dimension at the center of the balloon. Just like in our own universe, we don't believe that you can point anywhere in our three-dimensional universe and say, that's where the Big Bang happened, in that sense. And there is no edge to the balloon in two dimensions. You can go around the surface, around and around, and you'll come back to the same point. In a sense, and that's an oversimplification, in a sense, that may be what our universe is like in three dimensions. So if it is finite, we don't believe that it just comes to a wall, because, you know, I mean, the universe has to be everything that you can perceive in our three dimensions. So if it's finite, it's distorted in a way in which there is no edge that we can perceive. Or if it's infinite, then that question would go away. Let's see, I don't know, okay.
Is Mauna Kea a good place to build an observatory? I thought the place was a frozen volcanic area.
Ah, okay. Excellent question. Yeah, I will. Is Mauna Kea a good place to build telescopes because Hawaii is a volcanically active area? Well, fortunately, Mauna Kea is an extinct volcano. At least the geologists tell us that. We've got a few geophysicists in the back here. Am I right? It is extinct, isn't it? But yeah, Mauna Loa, its sister volcano, is active with the Kilauea event, and we have a wonderful vantage point to watch the Kilauea eruptions from there. But as far as we know, Mauna Kea is not going to erupt, and so it is a safe, stable location. You do get earthquakes every once in a while, which can, misalign the telescopes, and you have to do modest realignment. But that downside is far outweighed by the stable atmosphere and the viewing conditions there. So in fact, it is an almost perfect place to go for astronomy, other than the fact that it's freezing and all of your friends think that you're on the beach sipping Mai Tais when you're freezing your butt off on top of some horrible volcano. Let's see, there's so many questions here. I'll try to alternate back and front. In the blue near the...
Can I ask you a question about travel and space, or is that too unrelated?
Well, it's... If the audience indulges, sure, go ahead. So the question is kind of related to, I talked about the implausibility of traveling between the stars anywhere in the foreseeable future because of the vast distances. And this young lady asked me about the size of the universe, and I responded to that saying that the three dimensions of space and one of time could actually be curved around in one another, and those two concepts are related to one another. Science fiction writers take advantage of that notion that perhaps there's a way in which, you know, the curvature of space and time, you can basically fold three dimensions of space to bring two points which are very far away in our three dimensions close together in a fourth or additional dimensions. And that's usually the kind of idea of hyperspace. Even Einstein and another physicist named Rosen theorized that if you had a black hole, a singularity, that you could have a bridge between two widely separated parts of three-dimensional, four-dimensional space-time. And they call, the physicists call them Einstein-Rosen bridges, science fiction writers call them wormholes. And that is, I mean, that is a valid theory. The problem is that these bridges, these wormholes, are so unstable that they wouldn't last long enough for even light to be able to travel from one point to the other and convey any information, let alone convey any interstellar travelers. So there are some hard science ideas in the ideas that you've been talking about, but there are a lot of practical problems and a lot of things which may inherently make that idea unworkable, and I'd be happy to talk afterwards about that a little more. Yes. Oh, I don't. Oh, okay. The question is, how would you make the so-called face on Mars? Well, I would, if I had the power to make it, I would make it the same way as Mauna Kea was made. The high resolution, the face on Mars, for those of you that aren't familiar, I had a few Weekly World News headlines there. They love the face on Mars as well. It's a feature that was photographed from orbit by the Viking orbiter, which looked like a bit like a cameo picture. You know, you could see a face, like a kind of a Roman mask. And planetary astronomers, NASA scientists, argued that, well, it's the lighting angle from the sun was shining on a natural feature in such a way to make it look a little bit like a face. But there was, you know, tremendous public interest in this, and the belief that it was associated with an ancient Martian civilization which had constructed an enormous thing larger than the scale of the pyramids that, you know, looked like presumably a Martian, I guess. Now, when the Mars Global Surveyor went to Mars, it had higher resolution than the Viking images, and it photographed the same part of the Martian surface. And if you look at those images, and you can find links to get to those kinds of images from our UBC website, to be honest, to me, it just looks like a mountain. You can see where the shadowing features made it look like a face, but if you illuminate it from different angles, it no longer looks like a face, and it really does look like a mountain. And so, you know, I think it's just a natural feature like Mauna Kea on the Earth. I know that there are still people that believe that there's a conspiracy theory and that NASA is somehow covering up this information and giving out wrong things, and I can try to assure you that that's not true, but then, of course, you couldn't know whether I was part of that conspiracy theory. So, what I would do is invite you to go to the Mars Global Surveyor website, which, you can find links through our site, and look for yourself, and you can decide for yourselves what you think that feature is like and how plausible you think it is that we might be hiding its true nature. So, that's my party pooper scientific interpretation of that. Yeah, over there. Yeah.
These sides are one wall. What is a characteristic wobble for the start
of life? Okay, the question is, besides our own wobble, what would be a characteristic wobble for life? It's the wobble is a function of the separation of the planet and its size, its mass. And so, for example, the Earth would induce a wobble that's far too small for us to see. Jupiter induces a wobble with a speed of about 100 kilometers per hour in the Sun at a distance of 5 astronomical units. So it's a hard question to answer specifically. We wouldn't be able to see just an Earth-like planet by itself orbiting around a star like the Sun with this kind of technology. We might be able to see a Jupiter-like planet orbiting at the right distance with moons that could be Earth-like in them. That's something which we might be able to verify in the not too distant future. But again, that's totally speculation. You know, we have no supporting evidence for that.
You
mean a time scale? The question is there a scale in which we could detect that kind of wobble? You mean a time scale over which we expect that maybe we'll be able to do it, or like if I could quantify a number? It's really something that kind of exists. You'd have to make up a plot of like mass versus separation and how that translates into the amplitude of the wobble. But there are plots like that, which I didn't show because they just got a little bit too technical and too cluttered, that just show you our detection limits and how far we are away from seeing something like the Earth. And I might have some of those with me. I could try to dig that up to show you afterwards. Yes.
You gave particular evidence in relation to 24
Mm-hmm. The question was, I gave particular evidence in relation to 24 stars from the Canadian survey. The question is, did we find any evidence for any kind of recognizable life, animals, birds, fish, on planets around any of these stars? The answer is unequivocally no. One, because we didn't find definitive evidence of planets. Two, the signatures of those things. Believe it or not, astronomers and scientists are looking at this problem. They're looking ahead to saying, how would we look for Earth-like planets? And not only that, how would we detect whether there's plant life or animal life on their surface, even if it's not signaling to us, you know, a la Gilligan's Island? And it turns out that if you look at plants, Earth Resources monitoring satellites, the kinds of things like the RadarSat satellites that are, you know, built here in Canada, and Landsat, they've discovered that if you look at the Earth at infrared wavelengths, that plants are incredibly bright. They give off a lot of infrared radiation out of proportion to things in the far red and the infrared. If we had different vision, if our eyes were better able to see in the far red, the infrared, then plants would be so bright, we would have snow blindness all the time. And so if you pick the right wavelength region, it turns out that plants show up out of proportion to other things on the surface of a planet. And so there are people that are seriously looking at what are the strategies to try to detect plant life on planets spectroscopically around other stars. But the technology isn't here. We're trying to project to what we will be able to do 10 or 20 years from now. So I could say beyond any shadow of a doubt that there is no evidence from any kind of astronomical observation of plant or animal life on any place, whether it's in our solar system or beyond our solar system, other than the planet that we're on right now.
But it could conceivably develop in 20 years or more.
The technology to do so could develop in 20 years or so at the rate, just extrapolating what we're able to do now. Yeah, I think that's a possibility. Astronomy is advancing at an incredible rate, even compared to other scientific disciplines. I know we're probably taxing people's patience. I missed you before, and I'll leave it up to the chairman to cut me off. So I'll just keep taking people until he tells me to stop.
Yes, some stars, when they end their life, become a death
carbon center. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's what it sounds like when they end their lives. So the question is that stars, when they reach the end of their lives, depending on how massive they are, they can die in different ways. And stars much more massive than the Sun, we believe, die in very violent explosions called supernova explosions. Stars like the Sun have a kind of end not with a bang, but a whimper, and end up with a stellar corpse about the size of the Earth that we call a white dwarf. If you could imagine half of the mass of the Sun collapse down into something about the size of our planet, if you were to pick up a teaspoon of material from that, from such a star and bring it back to Earth, it would weigh about as much as a city bus. Very dense and very faint, but very hot. And the question is could some of these reflex orbital signals be due to a dead star, one of these stellar corpses orbiting with a visible star? Now, the point is that we do see those systems. This idea of binary systems has been around for a while, and we do detect many stars that have white dwarf companions and neutron star companions and even black hole companions. But the signature, the velocity signature, is quite clearly distinguishable for something that's kind of like one of these stellar remnants, as we call it. These signals, if they're going to be stars like that, you have to be looking at these things almost face on. And the odds that out of all of these 50, that every one of them we're looking at almost face on seem fairly small. And the ones that are close in, the periods, if you had a white dwarf in a 4-day period around the Sun, the mass of the white dwarf would be so high that the amplitude of the wobble, it would be much, much larger than this. So there's not too much ambiguity for these really tight, mysterious ones that are like 51 Pegasi, but there is more ambiguity for the ones that are further out. And those things, you're going to hear more in the news. There are some stuff, literally, that I'm not at liberty to divulge, not because I'm part of this scientific, industrial, military conspiracy, but because the work is still being refereed. But there are some results in that question that you'll be hearing reported in the popular media, I'm sure, in the coming weeks and months. So keep your eyes and ears open for that.
I'm going to cut this off. I think Dr. Matthews has been more than generous.
No, you've been more than generous. You're sticking around.
I'm completely losing concept of time and space. Before I lose it completely, I'm going to call on Dr. Paul Harrison, Associate Dean of Science, to thank our speaker.
Thank you. Jamie, when I left my home tonight and looked up the starry sky, I knew I was in for a special evening's entertainment. You're so well known at UBC for your ability to make science come alive for your students, and it's been a real pleasure to hear you do that here, share your enthusiasm and knowledge for this audience. There was one disappointing part, however. You didn't tell us the size of the traffic fine we could expect for trying to Doppler shift a yellow light. But barring that, I think you'll all agree that this has been a most entertaining evening. And I'd like the Vancouver Institute audience to share again our appreciation for Jamie's talk. Mm-hmm.